After the deadly terrorist attacks in Paris, Texas Governor Greg Abbott and a few dozen other Republican governors said they're banning Syrian refugees from resettling in their states. I'm Virginia Alvino, and this is Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics of the Southwest. The call to block Syrian refugees is being questioned. Some experts don't believe the governors have the legal authority to do it. More from Houston Public Media's Saida Hassan.
In an open letter to President Obama, the governor says he's directing state agencies not to settle any more Syrian refugees. Abbott was not available for comment, but speaking on the syndicated conservative radio program, The Laura Ingraham Show, he said ISIS poses a very real threat to Texas.
We don't know who these people are or what they're doing, but we do know they are coming from a nation or a state that is connected with terrorism, posing very real danger to the people in this state and in this country.
Abbott says the federal government does not have the background information needed to conduct security checks on Syrian nationals. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick also issued a statement saying he fully supports the decision. But some experts question whether the governor has the right to impose such a ban. Jeffrey Hoffman is director of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Houston Law Center. He says the power to enforce immigration laws lies with the federal government, not the state.
I don't think that this is something that would be legal. I don't think it's something that would be constitutional. And I would also say it's something that's, not in keeping with our American traditions.
Hoffman notes that the process of coming to the U.S. as a refugee isn't easy. It's not a very efficient way for a potential attacker to gain access.
There's extensive screening. You have to remember also that the refugee resettlement process occurs after a very lengthy period.
For Houston's refugee community, news of the governor's announcement has been disheartening. Haider Elias came as a refugee from Iraq in 2010. He's a Yazidi, a member of the religious minority that's been persecuted by ISIS. Elias says people fleeing violence and unrest just want to live in peace.
It takes a lot of courage to come all the way to America. And when you're rejected, then it's frustrating when someone generalizes. Everybody.
State officials estimate about 200 Syrian refugees were resettled in Texas from September 2014 to September of this year. The U.S. State Department has announced it will allow up to 10,000 Syrian refugees into the country in 2016.
That was Saida Hassan of Houston Public Media reporting. President Barack Obama's immigration plan recently suffered a setback when a three-judge panel upheld a lower court's injunction against it. The controversial program would have deferred deportation for more than 4 million undocumented immigrants across the country. It's a topic that's on the minds of youth who are either immigrants themselves or have family members who are. KERA's Stella Chavez talked with some Latino students who were in Dallas for a leadership conference and has their reaction to the decision.
The 550 students came from around the country and Latin America. They were at the conference in downtown Dallas to learn how to become leaders and entrepreneurs, and how to embrace their assets.
What happens in communities of color in particular is that we get plagued with something called deficit thinking. Anybody know what deficit thinking is?
It's when someone focuses on the negatives, says a student, like thinking you're not good enough or telling yourself you can't do something, a facilitator tells them. Lately, all the talk about immigration has some of the students thinking about their own friends and family, like Samantha Cordier. She's from El Paso and says she has many close friends whose relatives are undocumented. She wants to become an attorney.
I want to speak for those who don't have a voice, and I want to just shine a light upon the people who are considered criminals or going against society. I want to help everybody.
Samantha is at the conference organized by the Texas-based National Hispanic Institute. It's called Celebración, and students learn different ways to solve social problems. Samantha says the conference is teaching her how to view things differently.
Rather than focusing on the immigration and how there's problems with it, we tend to focus on what we can do to improve our mentalities and to improve our perspectives on what others think about the Latino community.
For Fernando Chavez, that means becoming an engineer. He's a high school senior from Colorado. He recently spent 4 weeks at Yale University learning about nuclear engineering. He says he's also interested in aerospace engineering. He's applied to Yale and is also applying to Harvard and MIT. Fernando and his family are undocumented. He says he wasn't used to talking about his legal status. Then, this year, he was asked to speak to students like him at his high school.
They wanted to use me as a role model to show other students that we can be successful, that it's not because we're undocumented that we're downplayed. It shouldn't be like that, because we can still be very successful. And I really think that students see that as a huge barrier.
Omar Quintana is a senior at a suburban Chicago high school. When he was only 7, Omar spent a couple of hours a day for about a month helping his dad practice his English so he could take the U.S. citizenship test. His dad passed. And when he was 12, Omar helped his mom too.
I made an MP3 recording of me reading the questions, and then I would recite the answer. So I gave my mom my iPod and she could just listen to it. And she listened to it when she would go pick us up from school, or when she would go drop us off, when she went to the groceries.
She also became a U.S. citizen. Omar plans on using that ingenuity to become an entrepreneur. He doesn't have a solution for undocumented immigrants. For now, he hopes to use his entrepreneurial skills to help the Latino community.
That was KERA's Stella Chavez. There have been a lot of non-Texans talking about the southern border lately. Presidential hopefuls, public officials, and others all seem to have opinions on what's wrong with border security and how to fix it. Take, for instance, talk show host Sean Hannity.
Virtual fence, virtual surveillance, impenetrable border.
Not to be outdone by media personalities, Georgia Republican Lynn Westmoreland from the U.S. House Intelligence Committee also weighed in.
We're going to do whatever it takes to make sure that our citizens and our homeland is protected.
Whatever the public's perception of the border, people who actually live there are puzzled by these messages. KUT's Joy Diaz went to the border town of Laredo and tells us how residents there describe where they live.
To find out what people at the border think, I needed to get as close to the border as possible.
How far away are you from Mexico?
A block?
Lalo Garcia manages a museum very close to Bridge Number 1, the main bridge connecting Laredo, Texas, to Nuevo Laredo, Mexico.
And you walk right there, you're actually three quarters on the bridge, right here in that corner.
So I wasn't the right place. Now I needed to find out what people think when they hear Washington politicians talk about the border. Designer Bill Luft and his friend Elizabeth Romano Sames are remodeling a building a few steps from the museum. Loft spoke first.
We're watching national news and going, what? It sounds like we're having to duck bullets. Or something. It's crazy. It's just nothing like any close to it at all.
Romana Sames says virtually everyone talks about violence and crime at the border, when her experience in the 2 decades she's lived there is opposite.
It's ridiculous. San Antonio has tons of crime. Austin has tons of crime. How many shootings are there every day in San Antonio on the west side or the east side or south side? I mean, come on, let's get real. Look at Houston. Look at Washington.
The FBI is looking. In fact, it releases yearly crime statistics based on its observations. Last year's stats showed every city along the Texas-Mexico border to have fewer murders than other major U.S. cities.
It's a safe place.
Rubén Villarreal is the former mayor of Rio Grande City, Texas, more than 100 miles north of Laredo, but still along the border.
It's dynamic. It's thriving.
Now, not everything is rosy. There are problems, says Villarreal. They're just not the problems politicians choose to highlight. For instance, when Villarreal was mayor, his budget never allowed him to have a fully staffed police department. The city managed, but last summer, when thousands of undocumented children from Central America were crossing through Rio Grande City, cops were strained.
So my police officers weren't doing law enforcement work in school zones or in parking lots or in neighborhoods. They were basically doing the duties of immigration just to make sure that those immigrants got taken care of correctly.
He says their approach was always compassionate, not only because they are used to seeing people crossing the border through their town, but also because never before had they seen toddlers and teens crossing. Back in Laredo, locals will admit there are challenges. One is that the city's outskirts are growing, but downtown is all but dried up. That's why Romano Sames, Loft, and others are revitalizing buildings in downtown Laredo to bring back the boutiques and the cafes.
We have lots of projects.
They want to beat what they call the propaganda machine and bring tourists back.
Can you imagine moving away?
No, I wouldn't.
You can call it the border and can attach as many adjectives to it. Loft, Romano Sames, Garcia, Villarreal, and millions more like them call it home. And they love it.
That was KUT's Joy Diaz reporting. Coming up next on Fronteras, how much privacy should a student have when reporting sexual assault?
If a student makes the mistake of going to someone who is not a confidential source and telling them the whole story, then that student is going to experience the university sort of taking control over that.
That story and a look back at colonial Spanish women's lives on the border after this. I'm Virginia Alvino, and this is Fronteras. Sexual assault policies on campuses around the country are being scrutinized. This year, the Department of Justice has been taking a closer look at the University of New Mexico. As KUNM's Fronteras reporter Marisa DeMarco found, students there say the university isn't clear about when their sexual assault reports will remain confidential and when they won't.
Over the last few months, I've spoken with UNM students who say they've been assaulted about what it's like in the aftermath to try to keep yourself safe, finish school, or speak out about what happened. All of the students I spoke with called investigations at UNM confusing and said they take too long, dragging on for months. Chief among their concerns is privacy during that process. But you won't hear from those folks in this story because privacy is such a big issue. KUNM guaranteed them anonymity, but they changed their minds about sharing their stories. They said they were worried about how doing so could damage them academically or socially or even put them in danger.
The idea of being able to explore your options with some measure of confidentiality is a bedrock concern for many survivors because sexual violence is the ultimate violation of your privacy and yourself, your physical self.
Claire Harwell has helped many students through the process of reporting an assault as the legal director for the Community Justice Project.
After that, you want an opportunity to sort of cocoon, and it's important to figure out who you can talk to without that being taken somewhere else.
And Harwell says it's not easy for students to figure out what will be kept private and what won't.
The problem is that UNM is not clear with students who they can go to for information confidentially and who they cannot.
Near the on-campus dorms at UNM, skateboarders and bicyclists weave through pedestrians. The sidewalks are crowded and people are everywhere. Privacy isn't only an emotional concern. For survivors whose harassment continues as they try to attend classes or who might be receiving threats, confidentiality about a sexual assault means safety.
If a student comes to us, for example, the first thing we tell them is that we are not completely confidential.
That's Francie Cordova, the new director of the Office of Equal Opportunity, which investigates sexual assault claims and civil rights violations for UNM. Cordova says students making a report with OEO will probably have their name revealed during the course of an investigation.
We can have anonymous reporting here, but even an anonymous report to us may hinder the investigation in terms of us trying to figure out what the facts are of the case.
Confusing, right? Just to clarify, if you make an anonymous report to OEO, investigators might not be able to do much. That's also true of UNM's police department, which is where students go if they want their sexual assault investigated as a crime. Another question survivors face, do they want their assailant to know who reported the attack so there can be consequences?
In the end, if we investigate something and we find probable cause, we explain to a student that we have to forward that to somebody so that the person who is accused can be accountable. And the student may not want that.
Some university protections don't allow for confidentiality. That's according to Heather Cowan, UNM's Title IX compliance coordinator.
There are things like no contact orders, which is one of the things that we do, where you would have to inform the other person, this person doesn't want you to contact them anymore. You are not allowed to contact them anymore.
But Cowan says there are other options that allow survivors' identities to be protected, like moving someone to a new housing location or changing class schedules. There are escort services and also security services through the UNM Police Department. Students can review all of their choices anonymously at the Lobo Respect Advocacy Center.
So if somebody is wanting interim measures put in place and they don't want the university to take action for them, then they should go to the Advocacy Center, and the Advocacy Center can do certain things.
It's a lot to think about. And there are also completely confidential counseling options on campus to help students do just that. Reporting from Albuquerque, I'm Marisa DeMarco.
For women living on the frontier of New Spain around 1800, life was tough. But these Spanish colonial women were afforded more rights than you might think. To learn more about what can be known about these women's lives, faith, and economic power through their wills, I spoke to Amy Porter. She's an associate professor of history at Texas A&M San Antonio and author of the book Their Lives, Their Wills. Amy Porter, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Yes, thank you for inviting me.
So many historical accounts offer really male-centric perspectives, right? Can you talk about how difficult it is to get that other side of the story?
Right. It is difficult, especially in the area at which I examine. Many of the people on the northern frontier of New Spain were not literate. Considering that, there are not a lot of documents that women's historians would traditionally use or find. If you were looking at the Northeast, maybe women in the Puritan settlements, you have high literacy rates there. You have letters, you have some diaries, and I don't have those things. So you can look at court cases, government documents, and then in my case, I found these wills.
Can you tell us how you actually bridge that gap between looking at these documents and actually like extrapolating the information about, you know, the most telling things about these women's lives?
It was hard at first. When I first looked at the documents, I knew that there was a wealth of information there, but I couldn't sort through it initially. Mm-hmm. And I started to read them, hundreds of them. I put together a database, and I created many different categories: who they were married to, how many children they had, everything they owned. And after a while, I started to see the patterns.
What else from that information, that very quantitative information that you sometimes get from a will, how else can you discover about women's sort of values or faith or what they cared about at this time?
Right. I would say first and foremost, these wills are a spiritual act. I think from our modern perspective, we tend to think of wills as being primarily economic, and it's about the money or the land and the distribution of that estate.
Right.
But these wills, they start with prayers and making sure that everything will happen after a person's death in the way they want it to guarantee their salvation. And then after all of that, you get to the material concerns.
One of the interesting topics that you touch on in your book is women's economic activity. Can you describe the extent or the scope of how women participated in the economy?
So the frontier areas of New Spain, they were difficult places to live. We have, low life expectancy, high mortality rates. There are some Indians, the Comanches, that are extremely powerful, that are raiding quite frequently in some places. So very difficult place to live. What this meant was that if you survived, if you had some money, some land, some cattle, you are absolutely vital to the survival of your family and those settlements. And women survived. If they survived childbirth, then they were likely to outlive their husbands. And under the Spanish system, because of laws that were in place under Spain, women could own property, they could bring property into marriage, they could write these wills, they can sign contracts, they can operate businesses. There's also community property laws, so that everything a couple earns during the marriage belongs to each of them equally. This is a Spanish system. It's very different from the British system.
But it's still a patriarchal society, right? So, but it sounds like women were, you know, lending money, in some cases, operating businesses. How do we reconcile those two ideas where they were, you know, empowered to an extent, were given a lot of rights, but still under this more traditional gender role?
I think this is one of the great contradictions of women in these Spanish societies. They have these strong property rights, yet there is this cultural system in place where the families are organized, where the male is the head of household and has this traditional power. One of the things that I argue in my work is that the circumstances and opportunities of life on the frontier and the laws that are in place allow women to exercise some independence. And this sort of scrapes away a little bit at that patriarchal system.
Can you give us an example then of how this Spanish property rights system could play out in a woman's life at this time?
I have a favorite will from San Antonio. A favorite will. That sounds so strange. But I have a favorite story from one of these wills where this woman says that her husband sold some of her jewelry without her consent, and he had some new construction done on the house, and she claims this door and this new construction on the house until he reimburses her for her jewelry. So sometimes it leads to conflicts, but what we see in this case is that she knows her rights and she's defending them. She's using the court to do so. And I think she's ultimately successful to some degree.
Amy Porter, Associate Professor of History at Texas A&M San Antonio, thanks again.
Thank you.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website. That's tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. And Trenga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Virginia Elvino at Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for joining us.